Starting Grid, die Formel-1-Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Ole Waschkau in Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de.
Keep racing
auf meinsportpodcast.de.
Einen schönen guten Tag und herzlich willkommen zu Starting Grid, eurem Formel-1-Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Mein Name ist Kevin Scheuren und heute haben wir etwas ganz Besonderes für euch vorbereitet, ein Interview, auf das ich mich sehr freue. Das darf ich führen mit dem Chefredakteur vom Motorsport Network Germany, dem Portal motorsporttotal.com, formel1.de und de.motorsport.com, Christian Nimmervoll. Hallo Christian.
Hallo Kevin. Wir werden das Interview aber nicht mit mir führen, denn dafür bin ich bei weitem nicht spannend genug. Ich bin letzte Woche, so kam das zustande, über ein Interview im österreichischen Kurier gestolpert. Und ich fand dieses Interview sehr, sehr interessant und ich dachte, diesen Mann müssen wir auch in unserem Podcast holen, weil er sehr viel zu sagen hat, weil er sehr, sehr viel wichtige Dinge zu sagen hat. Und diese Person ist Matt Bishop. Wir führen dieses Interview in Englisch. So, hello Matt.
Hello.
Matt, thanks for joining us today. It's a great pleasure. And to start with, I'd like to ask you quickly to introduce yourself to those of our listeners who probably don't know who Matt Bishop is.
Of course. Well, thank you very much to you too. And thank you very much to the listeners. And thank you everyone for allowing me to speak in English. Because like most British people, I am hopeless in foreign languages. But hopefully not too bad in English. So I started working in Formula One about 25 years ago as a journalist for magazines, famous British magazines like Autosport and F1 Racing. And then having been a journalist in Formula One for about 15 years, I joined McLaren as director of communications, invited to join by Ron Dennis. And I worked extremely closely with Ron Dennis, Martin Whitmarsh, and of course the great drivers that they had at that time, Lewis Hamilton, Fernando Alonso, Jenson Button, world champions all, and then going forward through Checo Perez, Kevin Magnussen, Stoffel Van Dorn, and so on. And then in 2017, I left McLaren and was one of the founder directors of W Series, which I'm still working for 3 years later. And W Series, as hopefully your readers, listeners will know, is the world's first international single-seater motor racing series for female drivers only. We made our debut with six races on the DTM platform, German touring cars, of course, in 2019. And because of COVID-19, we were unable to race this year, but we will come back bigger and better next year.
I hope so, actually. I watched all the races. We'll talk about the W Series later on during our conversation. Where I want to start is with your socialization with Formula One. How did you get in contact with Formula One, not only as a journalist, but also much more beforehand as a fan? How did you get in contact with the pinnacle of motorsports?
I was a little kid who loved cars. My dad wasn't really interested in cars anyway. My mum and dad split up when I was a little boy. My mum definitely wasn't interested in cars. She didn't drive, but I loved road cars. I would walk down the street and call out the names and models of the cars as my mum pushed the pram down the street. I would say whatever car it was, all these British cars from the past that don't exist anymore: Austin, Cambridge, Morris, Oxford, Riley, Elf, Wolseley, Hornet. Now, of course, in every street in the UK, it's Mercedes and Volkswagen like everywhere else. But no, in those days, I was just a little petrol head. I don't know why. I don't know where it came from. And then, because you have to remember that Formula One was not on television in the United Kingdom until 1978, except for the British Grand Prix and the Monaco Grand Prix. But I'm talking about the late 60s and early 70s, because I was born in 1962. And in those days, really, there was no reporting. nothing on the television, very little on the radio, nothing in the newspapers. You have to remember that Formula One was a minority sport 40 years ago in the way, or 50 years ago particularly, in the way that it really is certainly not now. And then I happened to see, when I was, I think, about 9 or 10, I happened to see in the local newsagent a copy of a magazine I'd never heard of, and it was called Autosport. And this would have been 1972, and I saw a photograph on the front cover of a car looking like nothing I'd ever been pushed past in my pram before, driven by a man called Jackie Stewart, and it was a Tyrrell. And I thought it was the most fantastic thing I've ever seen. So I think I bought it with my pocket money, and I read it incredibly carefully with mounting enthusiasm and awe, and realized that there was this thing called Formula One, which was almost invented for me, because I loved sport, I loved football, I loved cricket, and I loved cars. And I didn't know there was such a thing as car sport. And I had stumbled across it, and I was suddenly a mad fan. And so I have remained these past 57 years.
Have you ever, in your youth, in your childhood, emulated a driver on a bike? Would you say that you once driven certain corners in your town, like Jackie Stewart?
As a kid, you mean?
Yeah.
Certainly. Not only would I trace the racing line on my bike, but even walking in the tunnels of the London Underground, the tube, I would carefully take the correct turn-in points and use all the road. Mad, I know, but that's what we petrol heads do.
I had a thing for John O'Leary's head cranking. I was like, when I was on the bike and I was going off-road, I was always like, ugh! So you don't see the picture at home, but I just did the thing he did with his head. It has to be done. Christian, did you do that in your youth?
It's always been a part racing in some form or the other. I remember mountain biking, because my sister is 12 years younger than I am. So I really grew up as a single child. And I remember I was just on my mountain bike, whatever I did, I always had to have a stopwatch, because I was going against myself, because I didn't have a brother, which isn't as sad as it sounds. So stopwatch and racing, it was always part of my childhood. Yeah, I would agree. But to go back to Matt, whose life is much more interesting than mine, Matt, how did you, or when did you think, I'm going to make a career out of this? When did that start?
I don't think it was quite such a smoothly laid plan as perhaps I could pretend. I think I worked hard at school and did well in school until about the age of 15. And then I think I stopped bothering. And I didn't do very well, therefore, in what we in the UK call, or used to call, O-levels and A-levels, ordinary levels and advanced level exams, which you take at 16 and 18. I didn't do very well. I did quite well at O-levels, but by A-levels, by 18, I'd given up. I was doing other things, enjoying my life, the kind of things that teenage guys do. All fun. Anyway, so I didn't. I started working. I didn't go to university at that time, and in many ways, I thought I'd probably fallen off a conventional career path. But then I found that I could write. I knew I could write. I was good at all the essay writing subjects in school, and I read voraciously. I'd always been a big reader, not just of Autosport, but also of fiction, including the classics, the great classics, and modern and classic, and so on. So that was always an important part of my life. But I wasn't really on a career path. And then I was doing a funny job. I was working in a betting shop, so gambling shop. You go in a high street shop that has horse racing, dog racing, football betting, various things like that. And they were It was big business in the 80s. And I was working there, and there was a man who I got to know who was called Jim Kremin. He probably wouldn't remember me now, but I remember him. And he was working for a newspaper called The Racing Post, and that meant horse racing and dog racing. And he said, you're a clever boy. You can write. You shouldn't just be taking the bets. You should be writing about sport. And I'll give you a couple of jobs. So he asked me to write a few pieces about dog racing, actually, greyhound racing, which used to be very popular in the UK and now hardly exists by comparison. And I did. And I found that I could find an unusual and create an interesting column, what we'd now call a blog. But of course, it was a paper. And from there, I realized that I was a natural grammarian, very careful with language and syntax and grammar and spelling and fact-checking and very meticulous in that way. So I began to get a job as a sub-editor as well, freelance. And then there was a job that was offered to me that was advertised at Car Magazine. Obvious what Car Magazine is. And they wanted a sub-editor. And I thought I could do it, and I applied for it, and I got it. And that was probably, I was already about 28, 29, so a bit of a late start. But the moment I got there, I started, I just fitted in immediately. I loved writing about cars. I began to ask the editor, Gavin Green, who's still a good friend now, whether I could include some motor racing copy. And in fact, Nigel Roebuck began to write for Car Magazine as well. Nigel Roebuck, of course, a legendary British motorsport and Formula One writer, and again, a great friend of mine now. And I began to write more and more. And suddenly I had become a motorsport journalist, really, a car and motorsport journalist. And then in 1996, Haymarket, which was publishing Autosport, and, the British car and motorsport journalism fraternity was small, and therefore we all knew each other. We met each other on car launches and at races and various other events. And they were launching this monthly magazine called F1 Racing. And they launched it with a tiny staff, which was a splinter staff seconded from Autosport. But then they decided they wanted to have the first full-time editor. And that was in 1996. And they asked me to be that first full-time editor. And I suppose there, via a rather circuitous route, starting off with writing columns about greyhound racing, dog racing, I ended up not that much longer later now as the editor of F1 Racing, which was the best job in the world.
Und damit kommen wir jetzt zur ersten Pause hier im Interview mit Matt Bishop. Danach geht's weiter mit weiteren Anekdoten rund um seine journalistische Arbeit in der Formel 1 für F1 Racing und vieles mehr. Bleibt also dran hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Zurück hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Das Exklusivinterview mit Matt Bishop geht weiter. Vorhin haben wir darüber gesprochen, wie er in den Formel 1 Journalismus reingekommen ist. Jetzt sprechen wir über die Veränderungen im Formel 1 Journalismus. Ein bisschen weg von Magazinen hin zu Online-Journalismus und Podcasts. Und natürlich sprechen wir jetzt über den großen Durchbruch von F1 Racing, von ihm als Journalisten. Das berühmte Foto der zwei Bremspedale von McLaren, Mercedes, wie das damals zustande gekommen ist, das erfahrt ihr, wenn ihr jetzt dranbleibt. Viel Spaß weiterhin. We will get into detail at your work at F1 Racing in just a couple of minutes. Just one quick question before this. Now we're doing a podcast, and Christian is the chief editor of a very popular German website, which is covering Formula One. During the times that you joined the motorsport journalism in 1996, the magazines were a big part of motorsport journalism in general, but in the UK, I think, much more than here in Germany. Christian can correct me. It just wasn't my time to read a motorsport magazine in Germany. So how or why were magazines and Formula One or motor racing such a perfect fit during those times?
Well, we're talking pre-website, really, aren't we? There weren't websites in those days. So how would one learn news about one's hobby if one's hobby was, for instance, Formula One or motor racing? So there were newspapers, daily newspapers, there was radio, there was television, there was books, and of course there were magazines. But yes, there is a grand tradition of, or at least there was, because the digital revolution has slightly changed that, but there was at that time and had been for many years a grand tradition of specialist magazines. And whatever subject you were interested in, you bought a magazine on it. Whether you were interested in cricket or football or motor racing or golf, or of course, things that have nothing to do with sport at all. They were the most extraordinarily specialist titles, all of which went quite well and were successful. I remember there was a magazine called Cage and Aviary Bird, very successful. Gardening magazines, cooking magazines, absolutely thousands of them. And people used to buy a lot of them and put them on their coffee table. And that was a grand tradition. Sorry, can you still hear me?
Yes, we can. No problem.
Okay. For some reason I disappeared. Okay. That was a grand tradition. And into that grand tradition, F1 racing slipped gratefully and easily in 1996. And because Formula One is largely conducted in the language of English, that's just the nature of the sport, it is. Therefore, the English language magazines were the most influential. And at every Grand Prix, when I arrived at a Grand Prix, I would find whether it was, you know, Michael Schmidt of Auto, Motor and Sport, or whether it was Pino Allievi of La Gazzetta dello Sport, or whomever from whatever country, they were very, very interested to see the latest autosport and the latest F1 racing. And we found that we were influential in that way. We also found that we had a great publishing opportunity, which is that although football is a huge sport, the biggest sport in the world, obviously, German fans want to read about German teams and players. British fans want to read about British teams and players. Italian fans want to read about Italian teams and players. But Formula One, there's just 10 or in those days probably 12 teams and 20 or in those days probably 24 drivers. And every single Formula One fan in the world, wherever they're from, wants to read about those 12 teams and those 24 drivers. And therefore, we were able to start a foreign language syndication of F1 Racing Magazine with very little in the way of content alteration. More or less the same articles, just translated. Occasionally, the odd bespoke article. When Jos Verstappen, you know, became a factor, then the Dutch edition would usually have to have Jos the Boss on the cover. But those were easy changes to make, and we realized that we were able to make a successful empire of magazines. When I started in 1996, F1 Racing was on sale in one language in one country, English in the UK. When I left to join McLaren, which we'll talk about later, in 2007, it was on sale in 34 languages in 110 countries. Fantastic success story as a publishing proliferation.
That's impressive numbers, Matt. In your first year, in preparation for this, I checked your biography, obviously. And I wasn't aware that F1 Racing was started as late as end 96 or beginning of 97. I don't know what the first issue was. But in your first year, you had probably one of the most brilliant stories of photographs, actually, which was the famous Darren Heath McLaren brake pedal. If I remember correctly, it was taken in Austria, I think, when one of the cars retired. Can you tell us the story, and particularly from how you as a chief editor had to deal with it from when the picture arrived until it got published? I figure you were in touch with McLaren and so on. Probably you can give us sort of the inside story on that one.
Well, now it's so long ago, I can tell you plenty. Actually, we put together the story over two races, which was Austria and Nürburgring. Darren Heath, who is a very good friend, was then and is now, I believe, the world's best Formula One photographer. And of course, this was pre-digital, and he used to come back with his films. And then he used to take the films to the processor, and he would arrive with the transparencies, the slide films. And then he would look at the light box and he would start snipping, you know, with scissors. This is a nice picture of Häkkinen. This is a nice picture of Berger. This is a nice picture of Damon Hill, and so on. Anyway, it was after the Austrian Grand Prix, and he called me over to the light box and he said, "Matt, this is odd, this picture, very odd." So I looked at it, and you know, photographers, they stand at the same point of a corner and they will take a photograph of every car that goes past, both Ferraris, both McLarens, both Williams. In those days, both Jordans, both Arrows, both Binardis. And he said, "Every single car, look, every single car that goes past, and I'm taking a picture here at the exit," that's an important detail, "exit of the Niki Lauda curve. So every single car has no glowing brake discs." Of course it doesn't, because it's the exit of a corner, so the car will be under hard acceleration, except for the two McLarens, both of them, which always have glowing brake discs at the rear only. Why? We were baffled. Why would a car have glowing brake discs on the exit of a corner, indicating braking? And why would only one car have that? And why would both examples of that one car have it? We thought it was extraordinary. Now, at that time, there was a huge amount of controversy around illegal traction control. A lot of people suspected that the Benettons had illegal traction control in a few years before. Famously, in 1994, that accusation was leveled frequently. And then Ferrari. People said that Ferrari had illegal traction control. They said they could hear the engine stuttering and cutting out on the exit of slow corners, which seems like illegal traction control. Anyway, it became an obsession of some of the British teams, particularly McLaren and Williams. What is going on with these two teams? Are they cheating? So McLaren had very ingeniously decided to create something that was entirely legal, which was a manually operated facsimile of a traction control system, in a sense. And we didn't know that at that time, but we began to dig, and we did a lot of digging, and we found out that McLaren had a second brake pedal. So it had a normal brake pedal for stopping and slowing for corners, but then it had a little brake pedal to the left of that main brake pedal.
Matt, can I interrupt you there for a question in between? When you say a lot of digging and found out, it means that you were aware of the second brake pedal before the picture was taken?
No, not before the picture that of the glowing brake discs, but before the next picture was taken. Yeah. Yes, we were aware. We had found out via sources.
So that Darren knew what he should look for. That's what I'm asking, basically.
No, when Darren was taking the photographs, he didn't know. When he was taking photographs, the first time we heard of this is, as I say, when we saw the pictures of the glowing brake discs at the A1 ring, or the Lauda curve. That was the first. And then after that, if you're talking about for the next picture, yes.
Yes.
What he, but I will explain, Christian. I will explain. So we realized that there was a switchable system manual so that we had done digging and we had found out that the McLaren had a system which was entirely legal, which trimmed away understeer, if you like, and wasn't really traction control, but trimmed away understeer by acting on the inside rear in order to tuck the front in on the acceleration path outside of corners. And it was switchable to left or right, and Häkkinen and Coulthard had to operate a cockpit-mounted switch to prime it to operate on the left or the right. And then as they accelerated, they would accelerate hard with the right foot and just touch the secondary brake pedal with the left foot in order to tuck the car in and prevent understeer or plowing wide in order to make a neat and strong and optimal acceleration path. We found that out. So now in order to prove that, we had to find a picture. How could we do a picture inside the McLaren footwell? Not easy. Not easy. But the next race was Nürburgring. This is talking about 1997. And Darren and I were the only people who knew about this, really, at the time. I think that we were very, very secretive about it, but we had been preparing the story. And I said, Darren, get a paddock bike. So he borrowed one off Jordan, the Jordan team, a paddock bike. And he was riding that around the circuit, taking his pictures. I said, keep your mobile close to your ear, because of racing cars, of course, were very loud in those days, not so much now. So you won't miss my call. If I see a McLaren break down anywhere on the circuit, and I'll be watching the television pictures, I will tell you, go to turn two or go to turn six. And you just get on that bike and go as fast as you can and see if you can put your camera down into the cockpit and take photographs of the footwell. He said, I'll have a go. Might not be easy. Anyway, as you remember, that race, the McLarens were leading first and second. With all the Mercedes senior people there, because, of course, it was McLaren-Mercedes those days, and they were looking to win and come second. And the great, you know, having not won a race for a while, this was prior to the triumphs of 98 and 99, and then to the great embarrassment of Mercedes-Benz, both McLarens broke down at the end of the pit straight, both in first and second position. I got on the phone. I said, Darren, get down the end of the pit straight. They've both stopped. Get down there. So he zoomed down on his little yellow paddock scooter and he saw Coulthard and Häkkinen's cars maybe only 30 meters away from each other. He got there. There were marshals slowly walking over to them. He wanted to get before the marshals. He arrived, ran over to Coulthard's car. The Coulthard had put the steering wheel back in, which, of course, you're supposed to do. And Darren just couldn't quite manage to get his camera down inside the footwell past the steering wheel. So he ran over to Häkkinen's car. And Häkkinen, who'd been leading and therefore probably even more frustrated than Coulthard, had not bothered to put the steering wheel in. He just dropped it on the seat, which, by the way, he was never fined for, but probably a bit late now. Anyway, Darren thought fantastic. So he was able to get his camera all the way down into the footwell and photograph blind. Now, remember, it's not digital photography. He wasn't going to be able to see the results of his photographs for 48 hours or 24. So he was just taking pictures and then altering the exposure, taking pictures, altering the focus, taking as many pictures as he could, just hoping that one of the pictures, the camera would be aimed in the right place and would be sharp and show a perfect picture of accelerator, brake, and secondary brake pedal, which we knew was there, but he couldn't even see. because he just hoped his viewfinder, his lens, would see. Anyway, by that time, the marshals got there. What are you doing there? Get away. So he got away, got on his bike, and rode back away from the scene. We couldn't wait to see the pictures. We flew back to England, to London, got them processed, and Darren called me on his mobile from the processor. He said, mate, you won't believe it. We've got an absolutely perfect shot. It shows everything. We've got a perfect story. We've got the two pictures of the glowing brake pedals. We've got the close-up of the pedals in the footwell. And I said, and I've got all the facts, and I'm now going to write the story. And we wrote the story. And when that came out, that was an amazing coup. And that was, for Darren and me individually, that was both very, very, you know, good for us both, me as an editor and him as a photographer. Because a monthly magazine had scooped everyone. Scooped the weeklies, scooped the newspapers, scooped the telly, scooped the radio. A monthly magazine had scooped it. And it so happened that Max Mosley, who was the FIA president at that time, everybody subscribed to F1 Racing, but he read his copy of F1 Racing and he saw this double page spread news story. He knew that Ron Dennis would go mad. And of course, you know, Ron Dennis and Max Mosley, not friends. And there was a meeting at a Heathrow hotel with all the team principals, you know, Jean Todt, Ron Dennis, Eddie Jordan, Frank Williams, all of them. And Max Mosley waited till the very, very beginning. He could have gone up and showed Ron earlier, but he didn't. Waited till everybody was sitting down. And then Max said, oh, by the way, Ron, have you seen this? And he lifted up the magazine and showed Ron the double page spread. Of course, Ron was incandescent with rage and had to sit through 2 hours of meeting before he could actually look at it himself.
Which was that the first time Ron heard about the story? Do you know that?
That was the first time. That was the first time. At a team principals meeting with Max Mosley deliberately tormenting him. And of course, the other team principals all thinking it was utterly hilarious. Anyway, at the end of the meeting, Ron came running over and showed me that magazine. I heard about this from all the other team principals, the ones I knew well, you know, Eddie Jordan and so on. Oh, it was brilliant, Matt. It was fantastic. It was so funny. They were telling me all these things. Anyway, Ron then, complete comprehensive sense of humor failure. Not surprising, you know, Formula One is driver against driver, but it's also team against team and therefore engineer against engineer. And he and his engineers at McLaren had felt absolutely certain that they were in some way unfairly and perhaps illegally disadvantaged by clever illegal traction control systems run by Ferrari and Benetton. He may have been wrong about that, by the way, but he and indeed Frank Williams were both of that belief. And here was Ron having found a clever and legal way to achieve the same dynamic effect on a vehicle. And two crummy little journalists, or one crummy little journalist and a crummy little photographer, had spoiled his party. He was furious. It's amazing when you think about it that I ended up working for him, but that was many years away still. It was an extraordinary thing. And then the next race that happened after that issue of F1 Racing came out was the famous race, the last race of the 1997 season at Jerez. And Ron was absolutely livid. He actually blamed Darren Heath much more than he blamed me, which was, in a way, inaccurate, because obviously it was down to me as the editor what we decided to put in the magazine. But anyway, Darren got the blame, or more of the blame. And Ron was absolutely furious. I can still see in my mind's eye Ron walking up to Darren Heath in the Jerez paddock and just, you know, furious, trembling with rage. trembling with rage. He also assumed that the photograph had been created by breaking and entering. He assumed that we had burgled, actually got ourselves into the McLaren factory, either bribed a security guard or actually broken the door to get in, which of course would have been a crime, and we didn't do. And we were able to say, no, Ron, we took these photographs in broad daylight at a public event. He said, you can't have done. We did. How? Well, we're not going to tell you how. Did you break into my garage then? Did you bribe the... No. No. 100,000 people saw the photograph being taken. It was the most extraordinary thing. And in its own little way, it's an episode of motor racing, Formula One folklore, that anyone who was inside the inner circle of Formula One at the time, whether they were in the media center or in any of the teams or in the FIA, they knew all about. And unless you worked for McLaren, everyone found it extremely amusing, of course.
Nochmal Zeit für eine kurze Pause und dann sprechen wir noch ein bisschen weiter über diese sensationelle Geschichte, die Matt Bishop und sein Kollege damals aufgetan haben rund um McLaren, Mercedes. Also bleibt dran hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Kevin Scheuren hier, Starting Grid, der Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de, geht weiter. Unser Interview mit Matt Bishop, dem ehemaligen Pressechef bei McLaren Mercedes, Pressechef der W-Series, Kommunikationschef. Und ja, unser Gespräch dreht sich jetzt in diesem Abschnitt, das ist auch schon der letzte Abschnitt für heute, um ein bisschen weitergehende Informationen zu diesem Scoop, über den Christian Nimmer vorher so gerne spricht, die zwei Bremspedale von McLaren Mercedes und dann ein Thema, was mir sehr am Herzen lag, was ich mit ihm sprechen wollte. Er hat ein Buch über und mit und von Emerson Fittipaldi geschrieben und ihr wisst ja, ich habe ihn mal kennenlernen dürfen bei den Laureus World Sports Awards. Das hat mich sehr beeindruckt und natürlich mussten wir auch über die Legende Emerson Fittipaldi sprechen. Viel Spaß weiterhin hier mit Matt Bishop.
It's a fascinating story and I think it's one of the best scoops ever that I'm aware of because it's such a beautiful combination of information coupled with an image, isn't it? Because that's as good as it gets.
Yes. And I didn't realize, I don't think we realized at the time how significant it was and that 23 years later we'd still be talking about it. But here we are and we were lucky. We were lucky that Häkkinen didn't put his steering wheel back on. That was very lucky. We were lucky that both McLarens broke down in a convenient place, quite near to where Darren was, so he could get there before the marshals. Lucky that it was two McLarens, which gave the marshals more of a job and therefore more of an opportunity. And we were lucky that our that Darren had been taking those photographs at the A1 ring, showing because he wouldn't have had to, but he had chosen to take these photographs on the exit of the Lauda curve. And we were lucky. No, I don't say. I think he was skilled to notice that anomaly of the glowing brake discs. But then we were also skilled to find out further details so that we knew what to look for when we got to Nürburgring. But yeah, it was a fantastic experience.
You said, Matt, it's 23 years ago and it's easy talking about this story. I think there's one thing that you're probably not going to talk about still between the images at A1 ring and the image at the Nürburgring. You said you were tipped off by people at McLaren.
No, I didn't.
I know it's...
I said...
not tipped off, but...
No, I didn't say people at McLaren. I said sources.
Or sources, yeah, whoever. Yes. But you're not prepared to share who Deep Throat was, right?
I couldn't really.
Yeah.
Because if the identity of the person who informed us, well, we did a lot of digging, a lot of meetings in London late at night in pubs and flats and so on. But if finally we found the information we needed, but even now, if I were to reveal that person, it would upset Ron Dennis and probably cause trouble. Why would I want to cause that trouble? You know, one of the ways as a journalist you can find things out is if you say, look, you know this, Christian, anyway. If you say, I will, please tell me, I will use the information, but I will never, never reveal you as the source. And I don't think that actually has an expiration. It doesn't have an expiry date. And here we are 23 years later, and I think the correct thing is to maintain the anonymity of that source.
Absolutely, because otherwise that's probably the last story you get, because people will know.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah.
Matt, let us talk about something different right now. I like to tell stories more often than not here in this podcast, things that I've enjoyed. I was at the Laureus World Sports Awards for 2 years, I think in 2017 and 2018. And both years I met one Emerson Fittipaldi, and he was a great guy. I was lucky enough that I could have 5 minutes alone with him, which is totally unusual for an event like this. And he was so accommodating. He wanted to talk much more than we could, and he was super nice. Why do I tell this story again right now? You worked with him on his biography, or you worked his biography, actually. How did this come about, and why Emerson Fittipaldi?
So I was at McLaren, and we're talking about 2013, and I was the director of McLaren by this point. And 2014 was the 40-year anniversary of McLaren's first Formula One World Championship, which was 1974, Emerson Fittipaldi. Emerson Fittipaldi's second World Championship, but McLaren's first, because, of course, Emerson Fittipaldi had won his first World Championship with Lotus in 1972. Anyway, we knew that we had to find ways of creating some exciting events to commemorate and to mark the 40th anniversary of McLaren's first World Championship. And really, it came down to me as Director of Communications and my department to do that. Now, you have to remember that Ron wasn't very keen on that, Ron Dennis, who was the boss at the time, because Ron Dennis is not very keen on history unless it includes himself. So as far as McLaren's concerned, for Ron, really, the history of McLaren begins in the autumn of 1980. Anything before then is it's a question of before Christ and after Christ. So I know I'm being a bit cheeky here, but I do know Ron Dennis very well, and even if he heard me saying this, he'd probably be slightly annoyed, but not very. I have huge regard for Ron, and we may talk about Ron later. But yes, he's not big on pre-Ron Dennis history. So he certainly didn't want to have a lot of money spent on any commemorations of the 40 years. So I had to find stealthy ways, secret ways, not dishonest, but just ways I could get things done for little money or no money. So I approached Emerson Fittipaldi. By the way, Emerson directly, but also his right-hand man, Fernando Paiva, who's a wonderful guy, who also Brazilian, who's worked with him for many, many years. Anyway, I spoke to them and I said, look, we would love Emerson to come to Monza 2014, and then we'd get him interviewed and sponsors and all the other things we could do in order to commemorate the 40 years. So Emerson said, or Fernando said, yeah, we can do that, but obviously, you know, we have to pay first-class travel from Miami for Emerson, for his wife, for me, for various other people, have to all stay in the best hotels, plus we all need a day rate. It was going to be tens and tens and tens of thousands of pounds. So that wasn't going to be possible. So I thought, what way could I do this? So I said, what about if I write a book? What if I write a book free of charge? I will not earn a penny personally from it. Free of charge, and it can be ostensibly by Emerson Fittipaldi, and all profits you guys can take. We will market it. I will do it with my old friends at Haymarket, F1 Racing, Autosport, And you and they can share the profits. I will take no profits. McLaren will take no profits. But you will have this book to market, and I will provide it all for you. I'll put you together with Haymarket, and I'll do all the writing. I'll do the proofreading. I'll do all the design, or my colleagues will. We'll get everything done. And the quid pro quo is that you guys have to turn up at Monza and be McLaren guests and do all the things we want to do. They said yes. So that was in 2013. So I knew it wasn't going to be a huge autobiography that was going from birth to the current day, because, you know, that would be a big, big job for a man who was already in his late 60s. But I thought it could be a themed picture book. And so we decided to make, I think, 12 chapters from memory. And they were done in 12 phone calls. They were done in 12 phone calls. Probably half an hour, 45 minutes, perhaps an hour per phone call. And I would call him. I knew, luckily, I know the details of that period incredibly well. So I really didn't even need to do very much research. You know, if I was asking Emerson Fittipaldi about, you know, the 1978 Brazilian Grand Prix when he was second in a Fittipaldi Copasuka, I mean, I could probably even tell you the qualifying times without researching. So I found that quite easy, and I telephoned him, and he enjoyed it, actually, because Emerson loves racing. And he loves talking about racing. And his memory is incredible. So he would remember the most extraordinary detail. You know, I had a small shunt on the Friday, so the mechanics had to rebuild the car. So I was in this T car, and it had more understeer. I mean, amazing detail going back 40 years. And so I was able to create this book. And we found great pictures to make it a proper picture book, a kind of coffee table book. And he loved it. He loved the book. And during the course of that time when we were writing it, which was probably over about 6 months, because he was very busy, it wasn't always easy, and I was quite busy, wasn't always easy to find time to talk. And then when we did, obviously I had to finish the chapter before we spoke again. So probably took us about 6 months. Or something like that, between 2013 and 2014, so that it was ready to be given to all the journalists who attended the 40-year party at Monza in 2014. And the entire plan went perfectly. Anyway, during that time, my mother and his father both died. And if you look at the book now, it includes an author's note, which he insisted on our including. And it says that the book is dedicated to both those people, to his father and to my mother, who both died during the course of that, which is very Emerson, you know, to be so courteous as to include my mother in that rather than just his father, I think is typical of the class of the man. And he's very religious man, as perhaps you know, and he said it is dedicated to them, and may perpetual light shine upon them. Rest in peace, etc. Very poetic, very religious, and that book is actually, you know, not through any skill of mine, but through the spirituality, memory and good faith of Emerson to make the biggest effort possible to include as many good memories as he possibly could. And I think one of the best chapters there is the one where he talks about his enormous shunt in 1996 at Michigan, where he hit the wall in turn one at 235 miles an hour. So, you know, 400 kilometers an hour, and the accident came to an end at a different corner, turn two. It was an absolutely enormous shunt. And he was very badly injured. It was 113 G, the impact force. And he had broken ribs. He had impacted lungs. He had a detached retina, so he couldn't see properly. And then as his lungs, this is all in the book, as his lungs began to fill with blood, he obviously felt that he couldn't breathe, because you can't breathe if your lungs are full of blood. Internal bleeding. And he, it's extraordinary the way he told it to me, and I wrote it as he said it. He said, and then I thought, Emerson, you are dying. Emerson, you've had a wonderful life. You've won all these races, all these championships. You've had these wonderful experiences, and you have these wonderful children and grandchildren. But now, Emerson, you are dying. And then he lost consciousness. And he woke up in the hospital, obviously alive, and he had a religious experience on his hospital bed, which has stayed with him ever since. I'm not a religious man, but listening to him talking about it was very powerful. And I think he feels that the hand of God came upon him and saved him, and that therefore everything that's happened since then is a bonus, and he must be as good a person, as good a Christian, as good a citizen as he possibly can be. And my goodness, he is. He is a remarkable person, incredibly kind. And you told the story. And of course, I'm sure he was incredibly kind and courteous and listened to you and spoke to you. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. He was totally... he was as... He had such an euphoria in himself when I told him that I know about his career and I read about him and I informed myself and I'm a huge fan, and he was his eyes were shining. I don't know. I have never seen in an interview I did that the person I was interviewing had a light in his eyes when he was talking to me, asking him questions and telling that I was a fan.
That he's been asked like 1,000 times before, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
But I was so happy. I was glowing. I was glowing myself because they told me I'm the only one. I'm the only one speaking English going in. And I was glowing. He was glowing. Everybody was glowing in this room. It was great.
So it was a great experience for you, Kevin, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, he is a great man. He is a legend. He was a wonderful racing driver, a great double world champion, of course, IndyCar champion, twice Indy 500 winner. And, you know, in this wonderful job that we have working in motor racing, we meet some remarkable people. But for me, one of the great privileges of my career is having got to know Emerson Fittipaldi. And indeed, when my mother did die, when you go to your mother's funeral, I hope you haven't had to do that yet, but you will, hopefully not for many years. But when I went to the funeral, I went to the church, and you go early, and you look at all the flowers from this uncle and this aunt and this neighbor. And I was looking down all the flowers, and then I saw one from Emerson Fittipaldi. And that had been obviously sent from Miami. Well, it had been arranged from Miami. He didn't tell me he was going to do that. But I have to say, there we were in a little church in London, and there was a wreath in my mother's memory from Emerson Fittipaldi. And I have to say, class behavior, just first-class behavior.
We are celebrating 70 years of Formula One this year. Coming back to Emerson Fittipaldi, where do you think he takes his place in the legacy of Formula One?
Well, we can talk about, you know, top fives and top tens and top 20s if we want. But what I wanted to do before we do that is talk about the absolute legends. The absolute legends of the sport, and we classify them in many different ways because of their success, because of their speed, because of their aura, and because of their character. So the obvious ones are, of course, if we want to go back a long, long way, we say Nuvolari, Rosemeyer. And then if we say we only want to start in 1950, when the Formula One World Championship was inaugurated, then we say Fangio. British people say Stirling Moss. Not everybody else says Stirling Moss, but I would say Stirling Moss. We say Clark, Jim Clark, Jackie Stewart. Then we can start, I think these are all absolute legends. And then we can start arguing about should Jochen Rindt be included? Let's talk about that. Then I think Jackie Stewart, then Emerson Fittipaldi, then Niki Lauda, and then Prost and Senna. And then you lead through into the current era via Hakkinen to Vettel and Mansell and of course Hamilton. But in that group, and I may have forgotten some of them, that you would now obviously correct an obvious omission, but in that group, I think Emerson sits at the top table as a legend of the sport. Not only, of course, for his two world championships and 14 Grand Prix wins in Formula One, but also for the 22 wins in Champ Car and the two Indy 500 victories and the one Champ Car championship, but also for his grace and spirituality around the sport. And that there is a man who was put on earth to drive race cars, and that is true. And it's probably as true or more true of him than anyone I've ever met. Absolutely put on earth to drive race cars. And that's why when a fan says to him, I saw you, you know, in Brazil in 1978, or I saw you at Brands Hatch in 1972, his eyes will light up. He will, this old man who is sharing a memory of when he was a boy. And so I certainly put him up there. Now, was he one of the very, very fastest drivers? He was one of the legends of all time. In terms of absolute pace, you might put him behind people like Ronnie Peterson and Gilles Villeneuve, who would usually not be classified in the legend category in quite the same way because of their lack of world championships. But he was a lot quicker than his detractors will have you believe. Emerson knew exactly how to make a race car go fast. And he also knew exactly what he had to do to win, like Jackie Stewart, like Niki Lauda, in the most dangerous era of motor racing. Those three managed to come through alive. I know Niki has died now, sadly, but as an old man. But they managed to come through alive, just about in Niki's case, because Nürburgring 1976 was very close. And they always did enough to win. But when they needed to go faster, they could go faster. But if you think about that era, Stewart, Fittipaldi, Lauda kind of dominated those 20 years from mid-60s to mid-80s with a little bit of help from their friends.
Das war der erste Teil unserer Interviewreihe mit Matt Bishop, dem ehemaligen Pressechef bei McLaren Mercedes und dem jetzigen Pressechef bei der W Series. Es folgen noch zwei weitere nächste Woche Montag. Freuen wir uns schon drauf, wenn es dann um McLaren Mercedes geht, seine Zeit dort. Wie war es, mit Ron Dennis zusammenzuarbeiten? Gibt es Anekdoten und Geschichten von Ron Dennis, die wir vielleicht noch nicht kennen? Eine ganz andere Seite von Ron Dennis, die Matt Bishop kennengelernt hat. Wir müssen natürlich über die vielen Fahrer sprechen, mit denen er zusammengearbeitet hat. Auch über die, die es nicht geschafft haben, bei McLaren sich durchzusetzen. Da denken wir an Menschen wie Kevin Magnussen, Sergio Perez und natürlich auch Stoffel van Dorn. Das Ganze dann nächste Woche bei uns hier bei Starting Grid. Jeden Montag jetzt ein Interview, ein Teil des Interviews mit Matt Bishop. Zwei Ausgaben kommen noch. Wir möchten euch an dieser Stelle auch sein Buch empfehlen, The Boy Made the Difference, ein wunderbares Buch, was er geschrieben hat. Alle weiteren Informationen bekommt ihr über den Link, den ich euch in die Episodenbeschreibung gepackt habe. Dort gibt es auch ein Video, ein Teaser-Video mit allen inhaltlichen Informationen rund um dieses Buch. Und wir besprechen es noch, und zwar in zwei Wochen
wenn wir dann über das Thema Diversität, Homosexualität im Motorsport, aber auch über Rassismus und diese ganzen Schwierigkeiten sprechen, die auch die Formel 1 und den Motorsport betreffen. Wenn ihr ihm bei Twitter folgen wollt, @thebishf1, auch das habe ich verlinkt. Wenn ihr uns folgen wollt, @kevin_scheuren für mich, @mst_christian_nimmervoll für Christian Nimmervoll. Und dann bleibt mir nochmal zu sagen, vielen Dank fürs Zuhören heute. Nächste Woche dann das nächste Interview mit Matt Bishop und im Laufe der Woche natürlich unsere Analyse zum großen Preis von Russland in der Formel 1. Bis dahin, bleibt gesund, macht's gut und keep racing.
Starting Grid, die Formel 1 Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Ole Waschkau in Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de.
Keep racing
auf meinsportpodcast.de.